And you're listening to the June 14th pre-recorded version of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. I'm your host, Robert Norris, back with you again for this recorded session on Sunday, the 14th, on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. No call-ins today, but if you want to leave a recorded message giving me your impressions of the show, any reactions you have to it, or anything you think should be broadcast on the next show, leave me a message at 423-HUFF. 423-4833. HUFF, of course, is an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the organization I work with that tries to bring home to poverty pimps, bureaucrats, and self-serving politicians basic human rights questions that are being left unanswered here in Santa Cruz. Today's show will have interviews with Dan Fagan of San Diego Streetlights, a group that is holding a protest and has for 3 months in front of City Hall, and things are heating up down there in San Diego. We're also going to be speaking to Carol Denny of Berkeley on the debate over the nudism law, the law that makes it illegal for people to show their bodies, and the attempt to make it easier to prosecute those people that has been put off, thankfully, but is still on the front burner. We're also going to be reviewing the last City Council meeting. That was last Tuesday's City Council meeting on June 9th. We're actually going to be covering only a portion of that city council. We'll plus some older clips from the last few months that we weren't able to fit in on the shows when we could have fit them in. Phil Baer has an update about a week old, but still quite current, on the beach flats struggle to save the beach flats for its current residents and to save it from being given away as a sort of a bonbon to Seaside Company Charles Canfield. Stay tuned.
Rockefeller, Campanella, Communist Bloc. Roy Kahn, Walter Braun, Toscanini, Dacron, Din Din, Pooh Balls, Rock Around the Clock. Einstein, James Dean, Brooklyn, Dano, Winning Team, Davy Crockett, Peter Pan, Elvis Presley, Disneyland, Bardo, Budapest, Alabama, Cruise Chef, Princess Place, Katie Place, Trouble in the Suez.
We didn't start the fire.
Community activist, resident landlord, and general burr in the saddle of the city council, Phil Baer. Hi, Phil.
Howdy there, fellow burr.
Indeed. Phil, we haven't talked to you for a couple of weeks. I guess we passed the deadline for the environmental impact report for the beach flats, which I guess was the
26th
of May, and was the opportunity for folks to express their concerns about this kind of four-tiered plan to, quote, realign 3rd Street, widen other access streets, to set up a La Bahia Hotel project. And what was the fourth prong of that?
Well, they have an elaborate plan for connecting downtown with the wharf through a couple of controversial roundabouts that many people think are not really a realistic way of handling traffic, particularly when you're trying to encourage bicyclists. Apparently bicyclists just get sort of rolled over.
The significance of this plan from my perspective, because I'm taking a particular view, is its impact on relocating and destroying low-income housing, or actually I say destroying, because there's no real provision for relocating it.
Quite true.
As well as putting millions of dollars into a redevelopment scheme that benefits a large corporation that it really isn't doing too much for either the community of Santa Cruz, or more important from my perspective, the low-income and homeless community. And,
right.
And also has a rather nasty record of police and security abuse of poor people that
sure.
Around the boardwalk. So we've done some shows on this, Phil. You've been on the show before, as has Roxanne Acostapache and Keith Sugar and other advocates. There have been four or five major concerns. Can you briefly, again, summarize those concerns around the beach flats and then give us sort of an update?
Sure. Without attempting to prioritize them, I would say displacement of low-income people is one. There's clearly no provision for replacement housing that would apply to these particular low-income people. A realistic expectation is that they're going to find themselves homeless after this is all over. Seven specifically homes in the beach flats area or on the east side of the beach flats area that have been designated as having some historical significance, quite old and part of the little cottage fishing village that in a sense is Santa Cruz's old town, would be destroyed by the plan in violation of historical preservation and California Environmental Quality Act, cultural resource impacts. The placement of the street itself, the proposed realignment, shoved up against what neighborhood managed to survive the demolition, intruding that noise and traffic closer into the remaining neighborhood. The boardwalk expansion itself, which starts with a 125-foot roller coaster, the other two roller coasters create decibel level, sound levels that are what is categorized above normally acceptable, and this one would be closer to the residential areas than those, with absolutely no assurance that it would be any less noisy. And of course the visual intrusion, which it would loom over everything else in the area.
It would be 50 feet over. Higher, right, Phil, than the current one?
Yes, sir. And over towards East Cliff, a lot of the East Cliff and Seaside community neighbors are very irritated by the prospect of looking out at this blinking, glowing oil refinery looking thing shoved up into their horizon between them and the coast. The other elements, major elements of it, are the retail factory outlet parking garage in the main beach area, or the main beach lot it's called, that lot sited by Second Cliff Beach and Riverside Avenue. 225,000 square feet of so-called retail factory outlet, which is about twice the size of the Maynard Manson proposal that was so resoundingly rejected a few years ago. You may recall, this is a much bigger thing. And then La Bahia is slated to be done as a 275 to 300 suites only hotel conference center, and the people I talk to who have some sense of the kind of math that such a thing would require believe that anything that came anywhere close to providing that number of large hotel rooms in the conference center, in the parking and so on, would have to build up to an extent that blocked out much of the view from the Beach Hill area. And then the DEIR itself, I think, has offended people who were
DEIR,
the draft environmental impact review, which closed on the 26th. I think a lot of people who didn't feel very strongly one way or another about the plan, but who had some sense of confidence in the environmental impact review process and some belief in its validity, looked at this DEIR and said, whoa, this is a very weak and inadequate environmental impact review statement. All sorts of underestimations of impacts, traffic grossly underestimated, including just flagrant mathematical errors, inadequate factual evidence to begin with, all of it based on assumptions about this situation being comparable to other situations where they have measured the traffic and have measured the air quality, so they just use those measurements and impose them on this place.
Bill, concerns you've raised in the past have been the problem of losing title to what is actually state or city public property.
Oh yes, that one is rolling forward in a disgusting and alarming way.
And the water problem, that there's insufficient water to deal with the situation. And
yes,
the basic business of a rushed process that does not allow for real public input.
Quite so. Since then, I've done some talked to some people who know the subject better. The water, for example, the anticipated water demand that the EIR arrives at is apparently something in the range of perhaps 20% of a realistic estimate of how much water this proposal would in fact require.
So they're only giving us a fifth of the required water. They're actually going to require five times as much as they're saying.
Something in that range. It's way low, and I could give you some numbers, but it'd be rather complicated to follow. Air quality, the Monterey Bay Air Quality Board took a look at the situation and came up with determinations that in every measured air pollutant, reactive organic gases, nitrogen oxide, carbon monoxide, whereas the DEIR had concluded that the project would have impacts below the threshold of significance, the Monterey Bay Unified Air Quality District did their own estimates based on the projected level of the project, the information in the project, and determined that in all of these cases, the air quality, these impacts, these specific measurements on the reactive organic gases, the nitrogen oxides, and the carbon monoxide would all be, as they phrased it in a letter we have from them, well beyond the threshold of significance. That's typical of the kind of...
A lot of the organizing, forgive me for interrupting, Phil,
sure,
is trying to get a lot of questions in to the city manager, C.L. Cirillo, the redevelopment agency.
Yes.
In order to get the environmental impact report responses that respond to public input, do you have any indication that there was a lot of information, that a lot of questions that went into...
Oh, yes, there was quite a stack. We went in the afternoon on the 26th, and someone at the time told us that there'd been at least 200 responses, and many of those responses were like ours. They were 20, 50, 70 pages long. So I suspect they've got quite a stack, and I know that they've got some very significant issues that have been raised where I can't imagine how they're going to respond. Places where people have just pointed at their math and said, your multiplication is off significantly, and always, of course, underestimating the impact.
Well, their timetable...
Mistakes ever overestimate the impact.
Their timetable has been, I guess, to proceed by midsummer, and is that timetable likely to be derailed?
Well, I don't know. Perhaps the rush with which they proceeded might explain some of the rather flagrant mistakes that they've made, though the consistent underestimation of it bespeaks a certain pattern to the mistakes. It is something more than accidental. But I don't think that they can proceed on anything like that level. Though, of course, as we're beginning to realize, the EIR process is advisory in nature. It's not legally compelling. We could, and I think have, totally shot holes through the DEIR on practically every subject, and they could still just go ahead and pass it.
When is that likely to happen, that next vote? When's this coming up again?
That's quite up in the air. As you know, with the Terrace Point project, they have been responding to the public response to that draft environmental impact review for over a year now, and it still has not been returned.
But that's more politically fashionable to delay that, right?
Yes. Well, I don't know. My hope, at least, is that this thing all has to do with the saliency of the arguments against the DEIR, and it's something like you're talking about, where you just have a bunch of wealthier people objecting to a plan, so therefore they are effective in their objections, whereas we're down here in the flats and have more modest means and are therefore more vulnerable to just being ignored. I would like to think that ultimately there's some sort of legal legitimacy to this thing, and it does have to stand on some sort of evidentiary merits of its own, and in that case I just can't help believing that we've really thrown some wrenches into the works here, because we found some mistakes. I will charitably refer to them as mistakes that are significant.
Well, let me ask about the two groups, or at least two official groups opposing this. One's the Beach Flats Working Group that we saw a very good exposition from in the epicenter of the Santa Cruz Comic News about a month ago.
I thought so.
And then there's a second group.
It's a strange a proverbial grassroots campaign in the true sense of the word, that a number of people object to the plan for various reasons. Not everybody is in full agreement with regard to any particular objection, but there's a lot of overlap and concern in certain points of basic agreement, but other people are concerned that one group might be too radical for them in one way, so they sort of shy away from them in that regard, and then they come together on a particular issue.
Are these groups still meeting regularly, Phil? Is there a time and a place or a contact number you'd like to give?
I don't know quite. I'd certainly be happy to provide our number, 423-0170.
That's 423-0170. We're talking to Phil Baer, Beach Flats activist. Anything happening in the next week or so that Beach Flats, folks concerned about saving the Beach Flats from a seaside company takeover should know about?
Well, no. The next public meeting that was announced last night was early July. That phase seems to be winding down, and now it's all being mulled over. I would urge people to write letters to the editor. Hopefully the Sentinel will print something on this, though that remains to be seen. Certainly not printing our stuff, but they should be tried anyway, as should Metro and Good Times, the Epicenter, so on. Letters to the editor, letters directly to the council, Hope.
And you've been listening to Phil Baer on an interview conducted on June 3rd. About a week later, Phil Baer advised us that they were still waiting for the city's response to the environmental impact report public input, but feared that there would be, if the city's past behavior, city council's past behavior was any indication, continued ignoring of public input and a proceeding with the prior agenda, the essential destruction of much low-income housing in Beach Flats, massive amounts of money and property essentially given over to Seaside Company boss Charlie Canfield, and numerous other redevelopment projects initiated, which we've talked about before, which don't seem to be in the interests of the community, at least that's my reading. For those interested in getting in touch with Phil Baer, his number is 423-0170, 423-0170, and he's continuing to work on this project and solicits the help of anyone who can help him. They are going to be pursuing legal alternatives in the event that the city does not give more space for public comment and real public debate on the issue. He did express some concern that the main Beach Flats article that came out by Karen Clark, I guess, in the last Sunday's Sentinel, came 2 weeks after the closing of the public comment period, so essentially it became irrelevant in terms of informing the public so they could actually make meaningful responses that the council would have to listen to and consider. You are, of course, tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. We are the free and independent radio station of Santa Cruz, and we encourage you to send us public service announcements of any sort. My show is Bathwood Spears Broadsides. It airs Thursday from 6 to 8 in the evening and from 11 to 1:30 in the afternoon, concerned with civil rights for the poor, concerned with homeless struggles in different cities. Incidentally, is also the person who gives us our next report from Berkeley. Very up to date, on Tuesday evening, Berkeley City Council considered and tabled a motion to make it easier to prosecute people for the crime of taking off their clothes. And we're going to hear about that now from Carol, who joined us by phone several days ago to keep us up to date. She even missed work to give us this report.
Well, Carol, you were at the Berkeley City Council meeting last night. That big brouhaha in the papers about making it easier to prosecute folks for public nudity by not requiring a jury trial or a public defender. What's happening with that proposal at City Council?
Well, fortunately, the proposal was tabled, which means it won't come back until July 7th. That is very fortunate because they do have the vote to allow the anti-nudity law to be charged as an infraction,
mm-hmm.
and to avoid, as you pointed out, the ability of it's really just the explicit players and their supporters.
The explicit players is a theatrical group in Berkeley?
They did have a jury trial, and no jury will convict them. You know, it's ridiculous to use police resources in this way in the first place. And in the second place, they're really a wonderful group of live theater, and they are beloved in this town. But of course, there are many in this town who don't want the town associated with anything, I don't know, counterculture or repression. I'm not sure what it is, because they're not a sexual group. They're So really, the best argument for nudity I've ever encountered.
Did you go naked last night, Carol?
No, actually, nobody went naked. It was kind of subdued and serious. There are just a lot of people who not only sincerely support the efforts of these artists to pursue their craft, but also subdued jury trial is offensive to a lot of people in Berkeley. I hope enough people that we can pressure Linda Meyer, who appears to be the fifth vote for the moderator, who ordinarily only have four. So it's very disturbing to me that, if they want to try for a conviction of these people, they're welcome to try again. Because if you can only educate people 12 by 12, I guess that's still good.
Well, I know that the original law came into being because the naked guy, as he was called, came to city council one day naked and they didn't like it or something?
I suppose you could argue that, the naked guy was responsible for the creation of a law. Mm-hmm. But no, one person never creates a law. I don't think it's fair to him or to...
But Andrew Martinez is not responsible for this.
And what he is responsible for, in a very similar way to the explicit players, is putting nudity in front of people so that they have an opportunity to examine their attitudes about it. Certainly, that was a part of his effort, although for him also it was just a very personal matter. And in some ways, he had a very interesting philosophy. He really didn't feel as though it was anyone else's business in particular. And in a funny, there is a parallel to the explicit players. They're absolutely clear about the statement they're making, but I don't see them as combative. they're the sweetest people you'd ever want to meet. Mm-hmm. They tell you that way. I don't blame them for the creation of the anti-nudity law, although strategically speaking, yeah, you could argue that coming to the city council naked, it would push it over the edge.
But nobody was naked last night. Because that was what we heard rumors of on television and so forth.
Yes, I'm sure they were all looking forward to that. No.
What was the substance of the debate, or was there any debate at all?
Very little debate. Betty Olds made it clear that she's interested in amending the wording such that it's only about nudity below the waist, which would mean at least going topless would no longer be law. But in exchange for that, of course, it could be charged as an infraction, which would mean no jury trial or any effort to balance the law.
Why was the, if there was the vote to pass this, essential harshening of the law, even though it looks like a loosening of the law, why was it tabled?
It was tabled because they have the votes to do it, and what we're hoping, and this is the faint hope, is to pressure Linda Meyer enough in this district that she rethinks her stand. If she could find it, I guess the effort is to find her some kind of political fig leaf behind which to hide, so that she doesn't have to look like she supports nudity. And what's ironic is that she's at this point unchallenged in her district, although there are rumors that she will be challenged by Bruna Sima, who runs the Berkeley Board Service.
Well, Bruna has denied that, I know.
I know. So it's just a rumor. And, in my opinion, the best thing that could happen is for her to be challenged in this district. Back when Bob Sparks was alive, he always would challenge her just on the principle that no one should run unopposed. So it's a kind of sad situation.
So even though supposedly there is a liberal majority, 5-4 in the Berkeley City Council, there are 5 votes at least, or are there more than 5 to make it illegal to show your union?
There are at least 5. There may be more than 5.
What about Madel Sharif? Does she favor civil rights on this matter, or?
No, I haven't spoken with her. If she would. It'd be incensed at the steps of a jury trial for this group and anyone else. It's an open invitation to selective enforcement, too, in a town like this, because a lot of people go naked, and a lot of families go naked, and a lot of households go naked, and I don't know, a lot of fraternities have nudity on. I mean it's the most ridiculous thing to focus on.
Uh-huh.
So, it's confusing that at this time, it's right before the budget, a whole lot of stuff is being sorted out. Millions of dollars are flying every which way. And yeah, they're really concerned about, bobbing breasts and penises. It's wild.
So, I also hear that, that up on Telegraph, the police are up to their old tricks arresting people for sitting down, even though that's supposedly...
I'm going to be late for work, but I'm going to tell you the latest on that.
Okay.
Now, the owner of Cody, Andy Rott, and the owner of Larry Blake, Pat Romani, sat down with Shirley Dean and Pat Worthington last Sunday night and basically told them, yeah, they want the anti-sitting law reinstated. Now, this was a portion of Measure O, with all of which was thrown into disarray by your favorite district court judge and mine, Claudia Wilkins. But the city council did rescind a portion of its own law, and a part of that was the anti-sitting law, if I have this straight, at least.
I think so, yeah.
And that law they want back. The merchants up on Telegraph Avenue are, I guess they're most heated up about the little constellations of people that kind of sit around together, you know, on the sidewalk and enjoy the ambience of the avenue without spending near enough money.
Well, they're not paying taxes. Let's look at it that way.
So, of course, jail looks like the answer to this group. It's going to be a hard thing to fight politically because, a lot of these are young kids and they're, some of them are mixed up and not a sympathetic lot necessarily, not old Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. So it's the kind of thing where people are generally very frightened of youth culture in the first place. At least that's my humble estimation. It's the same thing as, I guess, decades ago with long hair was.
Or zoot suits, Fred.
I'm sorry?
Zoot suits.
I haven't seen those, no, but perhaps so. I know I'm not up on the fads and fashions up there, but I do know this, that what the Telegraph Avenue merchants want is what I call the 4th Street phenomenon, and you probably know what that means, but maybe your listeners don't. 4th Street is a redevelopment area that's actually near where I live, in the bad part of town, where it sort of turned into Disneyland. It's very high-end shopping, very expensive stores, and yet nobody sort of hangs around and gets loose down on 4th Street. It's pretty tight down there. The merchants can charge whatever they please because their clientele comes in from the richest areas of San Francisco. They come from Japan. It's like a new tourist hotspot now, and that's what they like. They want Telegraph moved away from youth culture and toward this gentrification for obvious profit reasons. And it's to me, it's a serious matter because, well, where do you go on the globe for, the really hot, creative youth culture creating itself instead of taking its dictates from TV?
Indonesia.
Indonesia. Maybe you will.
But listen, I would ask you a dozen more questions, but you're already late.
Yes, you bad thing.
Yeah, well, Carol Denny, thank you very much for speaking with us on this issue, and we'll try to...
You're welcome, and I'm going to try to keep tabs on what happens with this anti-sitting stuff, because you, of course, down there in Santa Cruz, are the masters of anti-sitting, and we may need your expertise.
We will have to bring our thoughts north to help you.
I'll be in touch.
Thanks, Carol.
Dedicated to David Silverman of the FCC from your friends at Pirate Radio.
We're on the streets of San Francisco today talking with people about the popular new craze sweeping the nation, Mayor Frank Jordan's Matrix Diet Plan. It's a revolutionary new approach to nutrition and exercise strictly enforced by uniformed police. With me today is a woman with a very slender figure. Tell me, Ms. Fortune, how do you do it?
Well, I eat a steady diet of service cuts, media defamation, and police abuse. And let me tell you, it keeps my reflexes sharp.
It's certainly not the traditional approach, is it?
Frank Jordan's Matrix diet plan does have historical precedent, but, excuse me, I gotta go.
Wow, look at her go. The mobile crisis team van drove by, and she took off like a jackrabbit. It sure improves your speed trying to survive on the streets of San Francisco these days. Let's talk to another volunteer. You, sir, jogging with the full backpack on. Can I talk to you a minute?
If you can keep up.
Well, thanks. You certainly are in good shape. Where do you get your stamina?
Take a look behind us.
Oh, I see. You're being pursued by uniformed officers.
Yeah, they're kind of like my personal trainers.
Well, what happens if they catch up to you?
Well, if it's a traditional workout, they'll trash compact my belongings and haul me in for a bench warm. It's a powerful incentive to stay moving, I'll tell you.
I can see that, sir, and thank you for your time.
So long.
Let's slow down a little and get another point of view. Here's the local cop. Excuse me, officer. What do you think of Mayor Frank Jordan's revolutionary new matrix diet plan?
Well, these local property owners are mighty grateful, and I'll tell you, I haven't paid a cent for a donut or a beer since the Matrix diet plan began. I put on 20 pounds.
So you're actually gaining weight on the Matrix plan?
The police budget is fat and happy, let me tell you, and Jordan's campaign coffers are almost as full as the jails. It's a great time to be a cop.
Well, thank you, officer. Well, there you have it, folks. A lot of satisfied participants in the new Frank Jordan Matrix diet plan, now gaining popularity nationwide. And now back to you in the studio.
And of course you're tuned to Two Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Robert Norris in the studio, or the recorded voice of Robert Norris. Can't call in today, we are going to be recorded, but hopefully we'll be able to call in up on the Sunday show. That's Sunday the 14th, when Skidmark Bob Duran and possibly Marco from the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz will be here, fielding a few calls and putting on a few loop tapes and raising a few ripples, who knows. And likewise, next week at the same time, when Baffin Sports Broadsides will be back on the air on the 18th from 6 to 8, I'm going to be out of town, and as I've mentioned before in past broadcasts, I'm looking to sort of phase out my participation in this program, not because I'm abandoning civil rights struggles for poor people, but because I'm looking for a way to do so kind of from a different medium. But again, this is not a resolved issue, so I continue to solicit your input. If you have comments or thoughts on the best ways to get out homeless rights issues, give me a call at 423-4833. 423-HUFF, HUFF being an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And that was a brief blurb from an old version of the Jolly Roger comedy troupe, which hopefully will be putting out some new stuff. They operate out of Berkeley, and Carol Denny is one of their members. Denny is quite a whirlwind. She also publishes a one-pager that is side-splittingly funny called the Pepper Spray Times, which you can get through contacting her in Berkeley if you want the address for the Pepper Spray Times. Give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. We have our own Pepper Spray Times down here, of course, in the sense that pepper spray is an acceptable part of the policeman's accessories used not infrequently by the police, without any kind of monitoring or criticism by our Citizens Police Review Board or by our City Council, in spite of the fact that pepper spray has been implicated in numerous deaths nationwide. The issue has been brought before the Citizens Police Review Board, or the Citizens Police Rah-Rah Board, as I call them, because of their favoritism for the police department and their failure to take any meaningful action, even when a fatal shooting like that of Happy John Dine is involved. And the Police Review Board has done nothing around the pepper spray issue, in spite of documentation brought to it by Stop Police Abuse Now, SPAN worker Nick Whitehead, as well as others. So, pepper spray is an issue here in Santa Cruz, police abuse is an issue, and the, aggressively, increasingly hostile attitude of the Citizens Police Review Board to citizens is kind of interest, though not really unexpected by those of us who've been watching the Citizens Police Review Board, by those who've been following my reports around it in the last few shows. A woman named Kitten Reynolds, who appeared before City Council on Tuesday night. Kitten Reynolds is usually a supporter of the police department in spite of the numerous run-ins with the police herself, and she's also been a frequent filer of complaints that she kind of works out through sort of an informal process of mediation with the police, according to the Citizens Police Review Board. She appeared, however, before City Council on Tuesday night with some critical comments about the Citizens Police Review Board, not that they were too lenient or too tough on the police, but that they were abusive to members of the public who came to speak before them. And this, of course, was a criticism that I can be quite sympathetic with, since the same thing happened to me when I appeared before them in April. Let's hear what Kitten Reynolds has to say about the Citizens Police Review Board.
something really concerning me. Not in favor of chairperson's behavior at CPRB meetings. On a meeting of May 11th, Ms. Rose had asked me a question and addressed the statement at me. After she called on me to respond, and I did so, she decided that I said and was saying something she didn't want to hear and interrupted me, attempting to shut me up. My time wasn't even close to responding to the woman. Another person, Tom O'Brien, in the audience, stood up and spoke in my defense. Then she attempted and succeeded in pressuring another board member into seconding motions, not once, but twice. These tapes really need to be reviewed. There is and has been other problems, not only with the chair, but with other things also. All members of the board really do need to be sent to individually. Tapes reviewed, and also, in my instance, my witnesses spoke to. It is not her place to pressure, silence, or individually veto other board members or to run roughshod over the very public she is supposed to be representing, nor be biased. This appointment is a very serious position and should not be held by someone who chooses to power them or breach confidentiality. Please, I urge this council to review this matter. Thank you.
This criticism is interesting from Kim Reynolds because she usually restricts herself to defending the police, defending police treatment of people they've shot, such as Brian Andrus and Happy John Dine, and attacking other homeless activists like myself. It's interesting, however, and I think she makes some pertinent points, that the new chair of the Citizens Police Review Board, Lisa Rose, has decided to crack down on public input. For instance, she has now made it mandatory that there be only 3 minutes of public comment at the Citizens Police Review Board. It's now similar to the City Council's strictures on speech. Previously, one could speak, well, up to half an hour, actually, although I don't think anyone ever spoke that long. I think I spoke 7 or 8 minutes once at the longest. They allowed you to speak at any length during the period of time apportioned for public comment, provided, of course, that other people would be allowed to speak as well, which was a much more reasonable approach. But even given that really generous offer of time for public comment, they didn't get many people to speak because early on, people realized that the police review board was, in fact, a fig leaf and a sort of a cosmetic tool the city council and the police department used to maintain the illusion of a progressive situation without the reality, the illusion of real police review without the substance. It's similar, for example, to what the police review board is doing now around the issue of administrative review of police shootings. So they've been spending month after month kind of tacking up and patching together a proposal that the police department will have to review, investigate all shootings in the CPRB, they can then review that investigation, which sounds good, but the problem is, of course, that the process already exists. Any member of the CPRB could file a complaint as an individual. The complaint would have to go through the police department and have to be investigated by the police department, and then they would have the right to review it. So there's really no need for it. It's a way of evading the much more important thing, which is a real independent or early investigation of these fatal police shootings or these lethal police shootings that are happening, like that which happened to Happy John Dine, the other which happened to Brian Andrus in March. And that early investigation or the independent investigation or the public hearing process, which was provided for and is available to the CPRB, is not being used. And it has to be assumed it's not being used because they don't want to embarrass the police department on this issue. And they don't want to respond to the public outcry on these shootings. They instead prefer to lay low and allow the police department to do its usual thing. It's a sad situation, but it's unfortunately the truth. I myself have sort of abandoned going to their meetings. I still write them letters, and I still encourage people to send them complaints to establish a record because of the kind of treatment that Kim Reynolds complained about. That is to say, being censored, being shut up, not being listened to, and not even being able to make a public record. For those who are interested in reviewing Citizens Police Review Board tapes, they can be found in the public library, which will also provide you with a tape recorder. Just go in there. The library hours have expanded, so we're actually open on Sundays now from, I think it's 12 to 4, I believe. Maybe it's 1 to 5. In any case, you can hear the city council meetings, you can hear Citizens Police Review Board meetings, and you can do so on the facilities provided for by the library. And they can be very educational, kind of interesting to hear. You'll be able to hear me jousting with the police review board threatening to arrest me. That was the first back in April. I played that on the show. In fact, simply for the heck of it, I'm going to play that again right now. You'll hear, first of all, the Citizens Police Review Board listening to the Police Officers Association spokesperson, who is talking, I should remind everybody, supposedly on the agenda item of whether there should be administrative review of police shootings. And her comments are completely off target. Have nothing to do with it. She's allowed to speak at great length. And then when I attempt to say, to respond to her, I am cut off and threatened with arrest. And this is done under the auspices of the chair, Lisa Rose. And who did the rule?
I'm the union representative for the Police Officers Association. For all the years that the Review Commission was discussed and since its inception, I've sat and listened to a lot of dialogue from the audience and have rarely responded. Well, tonight is my night to respond to a lot of the accusations that I've heard from the audience. It's frustrating to me to sit through these and hear people come up on a public record in the public to make random accusations against officers by name. Respond to a lot of the accusations that I've heard from the audience. It's frustrating to me to sit through these and hear people come up on a public record in the public to make random accusations against officers by name. And I know that you know that's what they are. Until a complaint is filed, they are random accusations. The fact of the matter is, they're said in public when there's absolutely no bearing for them. That's my first frustration, which I just want to share with you because I never have yet. In the future, I probably will again.
This would be Duncan.
That people come up here and have for years and have made, like tonight, random accusations against a named police officer and not file a complaint or make these public statements with no bearing. I've heard these over the years and I am responding to that tonight.
I appreciate that. I'm still having some semantic problem with the word bearing.
But people come in and accuse officers of doing certain things without filing a complaint, or in the case tonight, I have filed a complaint, but I'm going to tell you this anyway. I can come up here and say any hideous thing I want about Officer John.